We will. I think it's probably a good time, if there aren't any other questions or comments, to move on to recipes for success of RCCs, and ask the panel to come up to the stage, and we'll clear up some space for you up here, and apologize in advance for the leftover breakfast and coats. So so basically, there are three groups that were particularly successful and stood out. There are actually many, but these three really jump out in terms of their recruitment rates, and also recruitment is not enough. Retention, data quality, and grant writing. We've heard that these were some very strong grants. And so we're pleased to have them chat with us. And this is definitely meant to be interactive. I do have some questions for them, but if they spark questions that you'd like to ask, just please come to the mic. This is for you to think about how you can run your more RCCs more effectively, things you're struggling with, hearing how they're handling it, and ask the hard questions. I would strongly encourage that. So up here, on the far left, we have the WashU team, and we have Pete Banikos, who is the Executive Vice Chair of the Emergency Department. I'm so pleased to have his emergency department perspective. And Jill Nugent, who has been running the RCC for a long time, maybe since the beginning this round. Yeah. And I understand how you have a nursing background. Yeah, so we're so happy to have you on the stage to talk with us. And then next up, we have University of Miami, and Jose Romano is the interim chair at the Department of Neurology there. And he brings, is that another long time? I think you've been doing this since longer than I was a stroke doctor. And no, maybe not that long. No, but I just know you, I've known you all for many years, let's put it that way. And you bring a great background as a scientist as well. So thanks for joining us. And then last but not least, we have UT Houston, and we have Sean Savitz, who is leading the team there as the stroke director. And we have Chad Tremont, and you came down the traditional clinical research professional pathway. So we've got a diversity of experience here in the RCC managers too. So I'll start with the first question, and just to ask you each to talk about how you structure your leadership in making your RCC successful. Like, give us your secret sauce.
I'll start. So we have the Florida RCC, and we encompass the whole state of Florida. We go from Jacksonville in the north to South Miami. So we're geographically very dispersed. We have 10 institutions, 16 clinical performance centers, and we have an executive committee made up of the PI, the education and training director, the program manager, our lead coordinator, as well as members from some of our satellites. So we have James Meske. I'm not sure if James is here today, but James is part of the executive committee. And Dr. Barrett as well. So in our executive committees, we review not only how we're doing with clinical trials and clinical trial selection, but we also talk about how the sites are doing and if we want to add new sites
How
or
often do
not.
you meet, Jose?
Once a month. What we have found is that this collaboration about selecting the sites is critically important. The success is really, I think, made up of our participating sites. And we found painfully in the first cycle that not all sites were made the same, and we had to drop some sites. And we selected new sites who are excellent based on their strengths. We can talk more about that. So I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Jose. Pete, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, we came in to StrokeNet as 2.0 and came in a shared PI model with Jinmu Lee, who couldn't be here, in neurology, and myself in emergency medicine. And I think that worked out really well, giving his extensive experience with NIH trials and infrastructure in mind with patient enrollment. And that made a really collaborative environment for enrollment. And then looking at the map that Scott showed earlier, being based in St. Louis, we looked around the region and tried to identify sites that would kind of fit where patients were disproportionately not being represented in clinical trials. So we picked sites in Peoria. We picked an additional comprehensive stroke center in St. Louis, which is a very large biracial population. The other across the strait, St. Luke's, which had a very rural population. Arkansas, that had a tremendous upside and growth and opportunity for enrollment. And as kind of going into it, in not all of those panned out, but we really look to see if we could find sites that would add a lot of value. And our core site at Barnes Jewish in WashU was extremely high volume enrollment center. We had a great coordinator team led by Jill and her team that was doing tremendous enrollment. And we also added an emergency medicine core as for our acute trials in order to identify and kind of address some of the work-life balances of trying to enroll 24/7 and after hours. And that has worked out well for a lot of our acute trials. And as we went on and as we approached this next version, we had to have some hard discussions on dropping and adding some of during the last 5 years, some additional sites that really came to us and approached us that wanted to be involved that turned out to be tremendous enrollers and some of the leading enrollers of the trial. So we were very lucky by chance, but had to have some hard decisions, as you mentioned, for this next iteration.
I think you underscore a really important point that I think Scott has been trying to drive home to us too, that an RCC is not just like one high volume site. It's actually a collaboration that brings a diverse group of hospitals that ideally hits different geographic and diverse populations and goes across the domains as a congregated group. So I thank you for making that point. And Sean, go ahead.
Well, the structure, you know, for us is very deeply rooted in a history of a passion of enrollment, particularly at our university hospital in Houston. And, you know, we're so really indebted to, you know, leaders like Jim Grotta, who taught many of us about the importance of enrollment. And so we have leaders in our stroke net, like Andrew Barreto, Angel Sharif, you know, have really taken on multiple studies in the network and have shown very high rates of enrollment. So, you know, we have a very large concentration of enrollments that are at our university hospital. And then with regards to the diversity of our sites throughout our region, we have a very large region, maybe the largest, Utah might be versus us, I'm not sure. But when we think about Texas, so we wanted to make sure that we had most of the major health science centers that are in the state, in the metropolitan areas. And Scott showed the map, and it looked like West Texas is the place where we still need to actually gain more representation. So we've actually been bringing in more sites to represent more of the diversity, of course, of the state. So for instance, in West Texas, more in South Texas, and a little bit more in North. But we also have Oklahoma as well that we brought in, and that's been really important. It was highly encouraged by the University of Cincinnati to do so. We really wanted to be able to bring in other patient populations such as Native Americans. It's been great because what we've learned in terms of these major centers that have joined in is that they all have different strengths. There's no one site that's enrolling, let's say, in all studies. Of course, we understand that. But some are really good at prevention studies and some are good at acute studies. And it's really added quite a bit just to the overall portfolio of the various different studies in the network. So we're really grateful. We have a lot of a communication actually through WhatsApp and through email. We find that kind of communication is going better than having, we have these types of meetings with people. But just giving regular updates to everybody more in real time seems to be working effectively.
Great. Thank you. I couldn't have paid you to transition this better. Because the next question is, and I'd like particularly Chad and Azette and Jill to comment in, is how are you communicating with your satellites, keeping them engaged and helping them problem solve? So you know, how often do you talk to them and what ways do you talk to them?
Yeah, so as Dr. Savitz mentioned, early on, we sort of had the standard setup of executive committee meetings. We all got together. We had a smaller network at the time, so we were able to kind of pull everyone into a meeting. As time went on over the last 10 years, the attendance kind of dwindled. So we had to evolve and try to find a better way to reach people. So we sort of transitioned into just a day-to-day communication, like Dr. Savitz mentioned, through WhatsApp. It allows us to put stuff up there, just text message anytime we need to. He often posts publications that come out that prompt discussions with everybody. And then for me personally, all of our satellite site managers have my cell phone and they call, text anytime. It's very informal. And like I said, we've sort of evolved from the formal to the informal, and we found it to be more productive for our site.
And Chad, who is in your executive committee? Give us a sense of that. Are we talking like, you know, and I've noticed, I just want some people at satellites have created one point person. They may or may not be a trial PI for a given StrokeNet trial, whereas others just their satellites are really the PIs of the trials that participate. Just want to get a sense of what we're talking about.
Yeah. Initially, it was myself, Dr. Savitz, Dr. Beretta, who's focuses on acute trials, Dr. Grata, obviously. And then we had a couple, since we had a smaller network, we had a couple of our satellite site PIs. But like I said, as we've transitioned from that sort of formal setting, we just kind of all collaborate. All of the PIs and coordinators collaborate. And again, emphasize the WhatsApp program. We talk a lot daily sometimes on that program. So.
Yeah, and what we're finding is, but you're right about this, Pooja, is that it turns out that there's one person who's been designated at each site that's been part of our executive. And they, I mean, most of them are the stroke director, but not all of them. Some of them have been designated because they have more interest and passion for the trials. But we find it's much easier to have one person per site to represent the group.
That's helpful to hear. Is that, how are you guys structuring things in Miami?
I was amazed in our meeting, coordinators meeting yesterday, about how hard all the project managers and the lead coordinators try to reach out to their RCCs and the, you know, the coordinators. And they have like a structure, monthly meetings. We tried that and it didn't work because no one mostly came, attended the meetings. So what we've been doing is regular communication through emails, phone calls, text messages with our sites. And I review all the web DCU messages that we get every Monday, Data Management Center. I review them, every one of them. And I call the sites and I tell them, okay, you have this many CRF opens, you have DCRs that need to be responded, you have regular regulatory documents that are expired. So we do personal tailored communications with each of the sites. And also we have the fortune that our satellite sites, which are not only big academic institutions, we have community hospitals, we have private research organizations that are very carefully selected, because in addition to that StrokeNet site survey, annual survey that we send out and we collect information, we, in addition, choose our sites very carefully with a comprehensive survey regarding the research infrastructure and resources. And those sites that are part of our RCC are also part of the Florida Stroke Registry, that is a state-funded project, and also other NIH-funded projects like the Transition of Caring Stroke Disparity Study. And we take advantage of the quarterly meetings that the Florida Stroke Registry has, and the annual in-person meeting, and we bring them together. And in addition, we invited our satellite PIs and main coordinator to the neurology update and stroke intensive course that it's hosted by the University of Miami, and we had the opportunity to to show our appreciation for them, all the work and the contribution that they have, make us look good. Because everything is thank you to our sites.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that Ised and Andra do an incredible work at engagement. But as Ised say, we engage with the sites not only through the Strognet projects, but through other projects. So there are network of research partners across the state.
I heard that from what Ised was saying with the Florida Stroke Registry. You're touching these sites in various ways, and you're keeping StrokeNet top of mind in these interactions. And I think it's interesting that now the two sets of you have said we're keeping it informal. And I'll be curious to hear, Jill, how it's going at WashU and how you structure things.
Well, I agree with everyone. I think our manager meeting yesterday it just shows we have a great group of managers, and everyone tries really hard to reach out to their satellite sites. We do both as needed with our satellite sites, but I still have monthly meetings with just the coordinators. Our PI meetings are separate. And I think that's helpful too. I hear a lot of managers combine them, and I think doing it just with the coordinators they tend to respond more. I send the meeting out probably to 20 people, and on average I get 7, but it's 7, so I'm happy with that. The one thing we do is I go over the newsletter, because so much goes out to everyone, and so I really point out things on the newsletter during these meetings, and I think they like that. I also keep the meeting very short, like 15 to 20 minutes. Like, I try not to take too much time. We go over WebDCU. I don't call people out necessarily, but I do really reiterate that you've got to get, there's a time limit, get these in. And so it seems to work. I still get that smaller group, and then we just have an open forum. Like, did you have any issues? Do you want to talk about anything and things like that? But we also, as needed, I talk to our sites too.
That's great. Go ahead.
No, is that there is something very particular about the state of Florida, and is that every investigation or product to be shipped into the state of Florida requires an authorization for exemption for research. And we have to submit that application to the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation every 2 years. And we, as the Regional Coordinating Center, also instruct, guide, help, assist to every one of our satellite sites that are participating in those StrokeNet trials that are shipping in the investigation product, Aspire, Most, Arcadia. So it's Andrew and I guide them through the application and through the We used to do renewals, but now every 2 years, the site needs to submit a new application. So we have in our calendars, like 3 months in advance to remind the site, hey, you have to renew your application. And we always, you know, have that on top of our priorities.
Yeah, I think what you're saying really underscores kind of that organizational ability in the communication. And it's really, I know it's music to WebDCU's ears to hear that queries are being read, that blast of emails on Mondays. And it's music to my ears to hear that the newsletters are being reviewed because I think a lot of people we get too busy. And so that goes a long way. I'd like to open it up to the audience here. Many of you have successes you could share or challenges you've had. So I can start asking the hard questions if others don't, but do come up to the mic if you'd like to. Okay, well, I'll keep going then. One of the questions our executive committee asked, and this is a hard one, is the budgets never go far enough. And like I said, if you've been reading the news, it's not going to get easier. You're managing to be successful. I can imagine the potential creative ways, or maybe you're also still struggling with the budgets, but tell us how you're managing to make it work and be successful in the constraints with that we have with our NIH dollars.
You are correct. The budget is tight, and we made an initial error in our first round going in back in 2008, and that we probably over compensated some of our remote sites. We would agree on that. And our hope to encourage and support coordinators at our local sites who don't have a huge research infrastructure. And it was an investment at that time, and we probably were overly ambitious for that. And we did that at the expense of PI support locally at the RCC. But what we have done in order to kind of encourage for this next round is kind of smaller budgets for encouraging annual support for the coordinators, no PI support for the our remote sites. And we support a lot of what we do for NIH with a tremendous portfolio of industry-sponsored trials. So we create our coffer of money and infrastructure to support our work for NIH. We prioritize stroke neck trials over industry trials. And we also have coordinators that take on several stroke net trials as part of their main trials are responsible for. And we share a lot of that responsibility between emergency medicine and neurology cores. And it seems to be efficient by that economy of scale by spreading it out over two cores with a lot of industries kind of support to support NIH work.
Thank you, Pete. And I see a couple of questions maybe related to that. Toby from University of Alabama.
Can you hear me? The issue of supporting satellites, our partners, is tricky. We've done that from the first one. We did it this time as well. What we did this time differently, which I hope will work, and I'd love to hear your comments, is we made the payments milestone-based, so really contingent on successful enrollment, because you know, sometimes we put money in, and as you said, it was an investment. Sometimes it didn't pay off. So trying to link it to actual trial enrollment is what we hope that will work.
Thanks, Toby. That is a good model to know about. Do others have that model? Just a show of hands. I don't think we have that model at our RCC in its latest iteration. So yeah, it's a newer concept. Randy, I think.
Yes. Thanks. Yeah, it's actually same point in a way with Toby. We decided to put some distribution of our infrastructure funding toward our eight or nine satellites, and with the idea that it might shift. The idea would be based on enrollment over the years to kind of incentivize enrollments. And I was wondering if you guys had any sort of incentive for your sites or how you work that. I mean, it sounds like you have fantastic communications, which I think is key, but how do you keep people really happy?
Yeah, that would be good to talk about. And, you know,
So we don't have financial incentives for the satellites other than the per patient enrollment. We really incentivize them through engagement, not only in InstructNet activities, but in some of the other activities where we share meetings, we invite them to meetings, we pay for their visits to the meetings, registration, things like that. And we do it with funds from the overall research enterprise, not necessarily from the funds that that are allocated to StrokeNet.
And that hits the point that I was wondering about too. You know, I know some people have used industry, like Pete said, to supplement their NIH dollars. And I think some sites like yours are using departmental funds, philanthropic funds, maybe to help make things ends meet.
Yep. Correct.
Okay, thanks.
And to that point, we're bringing on new sites, we're trying to figure out, and we also don't compensate financially. It's just tough to do. But something that we've sort of transitioned to is offering, I guess you could call it my free labor in the most effort intensive part of a trial, which is startup. And so as we bring on new sites, I'm starting to travel out to these places and do hands-on work with these. Sometimes it's clinicians. These hospitals are just starting. They don't have a research infrastructure. We're helping them build it through the NIH StrokeNet, and also trying to get them engaged in industry trials to offset the financial aspect of it as well. So that's something, like I said, the free labor during the most effort intensive part is often helpful. And we also incentivize through the educational opportunities through StrokeNet is another way we do it.
So basically keeping them engaged in non-financial ways, education, conferences, and those smaller items that are a little bit financial, but also just make them feel like part of the team, it sounds like.
But also, as Chad mentioned, we're also helping the sites now who are trying to make the business case to get a research coordinator by saying, we'll help you to get your site going so you can get industry-funded studies, you know, into, because sometimes they obviously have higher remunerations than yeah. federal does. So that's one thing. And one other thing is we did have one successful example of where we went to a university and we helped the site PI convince the dean to put in an investment. And so long as that return came later in terms of subsequent enrollments. So there's sometimes we get successful in that respect.
Yeah, I will say, speaking for our Cincinnati RCC, we got some dean commitment for the first time this year that was really sorely needed, especially after those COVID times. So yeah. You know, something that came up in our executive committee that I wanted to hear some reactions to was that especially for the satellites, it's really rough to not get that startup payment till the first patient is enrolled. And there are pros and cons of that. And, you know, I think the model has been that we got to kind of see the tangible important thing before we release the first startup payment, and it sort of pushes and pressures. But some people are saying that it's just not viable. And I just wanted to get your reactions. Like, do you think it's working? Is it something that causes you a lot of problems?
Yeah, I think it does cause a lot of problems because, as everyone knows, screening is very expensive. Startup alone, I know what you're saying, like with the startup, there's a lot of hours put into that before the payment actually comes through when you're enrolling your first patient. But also there's a lot of screening that occurs that it takes coordinator time. And so none of that is ever reimbursed. So that's always a problem. Yeah.
So in addition, is all the startup process might have upfront costs, and particular for those institutions that work with the public community hospital. We have several sites in which the the PIs, the research group is part of the academic institution, but the actual clinical trial is conducted at the hospital, but both institutions are different and legally and financially separated. So to be able to start enrollment, we have to pay upfront the administrative and all the research pharmacy cost and upfront before enrolling our first patient. So it puts our accounts in red, deeply in red.
Thank you for sharing that. I'll keep going unless you have anything else to add there, Sean and Chad, in that regard.
Something we've done at the hub of our RCC is we've established a waiver system with some of the upfront costs that allow us to waive sometimes completely these fees, but at least delay them for a certain amount of time. But I think, you know, we haven't really heard a lot about the issues with when to receive payment other than just the amount probably, but something we can't control. So
that's a really helpful perspective. I'm glad you shared that. And that's something that maybe some of us could even borrow some language, see your policy, see if we can kind of get any traction there at some of our sites. I think that might be a worthy action item. So there are several more questions, but in the interest of time, I'm going to try to sneak in a couple and we'll try to do them rapid fire. But also, again, my highest priority is to make sure that all of you get your questions answered and you ask your hard ones. So don't hesitate to come to the mic. The first one is do you have a career ladder for your coordinators and project managers? One of the things that comes up in conversation a lot is we train our coordinators and then they take off for industry and they go get their job at their CROs and how do we retain them better? And we want to make this an environment that people get excited and proud to work in and feel passionate about, but you know, there've got to be career ladders too, but I imagine they happen to varying degrees and it would be good to hear some models.
At our institution, we just approved a greater ladder for different pay levels, mm-hmm. which will be helpful. Our greatest barrier is that many of our coordinators go to medical school, and it's hard to compete with that. We've lost two or three over the years.
It's not easy is the bottom line. Yeah. Pete, do you have any recipes there?
I don't think I have the recipe, but we certainly have an engaged research core from the emergency medicine and neurology side where we have increased responsibility in supervising responsibility as folks progress and get more responsibility and perform well. I do know that we in emergency medicine, we have a very large research core and we train them extremely well on enrollment and compliance and all those issues, but it's a very difficult job for folks who are trying to have work-life balance because we enroll 24/7, 365. And as a result, we lose some of our coordinators to Jill's team on a neurology side, which is it's a good thing, but it's
at least it's staying in the family.
We keep it in the family, kind of, but it works. So it's a challenge, and that's how we build it internally. But for a large academic institution, we have a lot of opportunities in keeping coordinators engaged and wanting to be involved in stroke research, which is really tough work, particularly some of the time critical ones is a continual challenge.
Thanks, Pete. I'm going to break over to Jenny here, Madrasik from University of Utah.
That's right. I'm Jenny from Utah. I'm also the co-director of the CTSI for our institute. And so I wanted to answer your question, Pooja. I wanted to bring out that in the new RFA for the CTSAs, there is a requirement for training coordinators, just like there was in StrokeNet. And so like at our institution, we now have free training for coordinators that lasts like 3 months and it's 50% time. And so you may be able to look at your own, and if you're part of a CTSA, to look at your institution and see what they offer as well.
Thanks for bringing that up. You know, when we were kind of exploring what are more ways we could leverage CTSAs, I think Karen was telling us about that too. And that's where the solutions turn out to be local. And we're going to be eventually surveying you all to see how you're engaging with each of your CTSAs to do that. And if we can capitalize on some of that.
Dr. Cotry, oh. We do have a couple of questions in the chat. Did you?
Oh, wonderful. That? Gosh, I didn't follow my own advice. Thank you, Emily. Please do add them.
This is from University of Buffalo. It's more of a comment. Is StrokeNet looking for growth? The incentive model has to evolve. The clinician's job is overburdened. with clinical duties, educational priorities, and enrollment. Invisible work is the barrier to enrollment in desperate areas. Research coordinators, training, and incentives in Satellite Center is also a big challenge. Enrollment can't happen without a clinician and a coordinator, and they can be funded only after enrollment. So it's a vicious cycle for the satellite hospital and department with limited resources.
That is a great comment. And I think that deserves a little bit of conversation for maybe the last couple minutes to say, how are you helping your site PIs feel that engagement? Because that is one of the silent, you know, issues, which is, again, busy clinicians, busy researchers, not much room in that budget. They're not getting paid for their effort. What are you doing to make that happen? Or are you just doing it yourselves as the RCCPMs or PIs, both?
So somehow I'm very privileged to work with a great leadership group at WashU, and our PIs are extremely involved. They're right there for us all the time. And so we're kind of spoiled. I don't know.
I think at some of our satellite sites, you know, sorry PIs, but I think most of the work is done by the coordinators. So we try to keep our PIs engaged, but most of the education and really the tough work that gets done, the enrollment is done at the coordinator level with some PI oversight and support, but we recognize that that is a reality of lower resourced satellite sites.
I would say that our more successful satellites have very engaged PIs that are self-motivated. I'm not sure that we do anything very magic centrally to accomplish that.
Yeah. Sean?
I think as Chad already mentioned, I mean, he's really, you know, he's continually engaged, you know, with the coordinators from the different sites and offering as much help as possible and going to the sites, you know, as much as they'll allow us to be able to do a lot of that work or to help them. But I also have to agree with Jose. I mean, many of our sites that are productive outside of Houston are because the PIs or the site PIs there, whoever's is the investigator for the study, is just really, really passionate. And it's just so important to keep that encouragement going, I think, on a regular basis and keep celebrating enrollments. And that's what we do every time they enroll.
And I think what we're hearing about is the intangibles, I think, celebrating, feeling part of the community. And then I will say on a StrokeNet level, as far as publication policies, we're seeing a shift where people are putting, you know, for the X trialists so that they get in PubMed. Active did a great job of that. There were thousands of people in PubMed for some of these trials. And we need to help people with their academic careers. And I think the other selling point we often have, at least with my own group that we talk about, is the fact that, you know, it helps build their street cred when they want to run their own trials. This is part of that, you know, trajectory.
So I just wanted to point out that our institution, almost all the StrokeNet scholars are now StrokeNet PIs. So they had the opportunity to go through the training and the support of StrokeNet and the support of our RCC, and they've become study PIs now. So that's amazing.
The career ladder for the site PIs. Well, I didn't get to all the questions, and there are so many more important ones, but we'll probably keep going. I don't see anyone at the mic with burning questions, so we'll let you set you free and let you have a break. And thank you so much for sharing, I think, some very valuable points for us to consider for the rest of the day.